Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Game Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rudolf Inderst, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Jeremiah McCall, the author of a Game Studies publication from 2023 called Gaming the Past, Using Video Games to Teach Secondary History. The publisher is Routledge. Before we jump right into, though, I want to let you know that if you like our show, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the audio platform of your choice, and share this episode and all the others, of course, with your friends. And now back to the show. Despite the growing number of books designed to radically reconsider the educational value of video games as powerful learning tools, there are a few practical guidelines conveniently available for prospective history and social studies teachers who actually want to use these teaching and learning tools in their classrooms. As the games and learning field continues to grow in importance, Gaming the Past provides social studies teachers and teacher educators help in implementing this unique and engaging new pedagogy. Jeremiah, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rudolf. I'm delighted to be here and talk about this book and talk about history and games.
Well, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. So my academic training is in Greek and Roman history. I got a PhD in it, maybe 20 plus years ago. And it turned out through this and that life decision that my calling was to be a high school history teacher. So I have spent the past 22 years teaching mostly ancient world history, but also modern world history and topics like that to high school students. And I do so now at Cincinnati Country Day School, which is a fantastic school in Cincinnati, USA. And I do a lot of work with using video games in history classes. And then I also do a fair amount of work researching and writing about history games just in general as part of historical game studies.
Well, of course, we have to check for your Ludo Street credibility. So please tell us, what's your favorite game and the one or even the ones you're playing right now? I mean, not right now, of course, but right now. Right.
So in my defense, I like indie games a lot. So usually the games I mention are not going to be like ones that people think about a lot. Right now, and the other thing is I wait for games to go on sale. So the one that I'm actually playing right now is Phoenix Point, which is a turn-based XCOM-like strategy game where you're fighting off aliens with your squads of soldiers. And it's extra fun if you name all the soldiers with names of your friends and colleagues so that you want to keep them alive and make them do well. So that is the game I'm currently playing right now. I guess the other little indie game that I've really been enjoying is, what's it called? I think Dome Defender. You're defending a little dome against aliens that are coming. This is the theme, right? Aliens, apparently.
Yeah, right.
Aliens are attacking your dome, and you have to mine resources in order to upgrade your domes. So I don't know if that gives me Ludo Street credibility, but that is the truth.
I think it's fine. I just was thinking about this alien stuff. Yeah, right. The credo is aliens, yeah. Well, your book, on the other hand, focuses on specific examples to help social studies educators effectively use computer simulation games to teach critical thinking and historical analysis. Please tell our listeners, how did you come to write Gaming the Past in the first place?
Great. Well, I think maybe I should first say, as we go into this, that this is very much a book that I think is useful for any history educator. Routledge, other major publishing companies have a sense of what markets you have to target when you're writing and titling your book. And apparently, I figure this out in bits and pieces, apparently there's a sense that people who claim to write books that are both for high school and college educators tend to get more roundly heavily criticized. So I had to pick one. And so I picked where my heart is and where my primary work is with high school history teaching or secondary school teaching. But I really think this is useful for any history educator at any level. But okay, so that said, I was struck by the power of doing interactive, more experiential learning with my students from an early age when I was teaching Western Civ, back when they called it Western Civ in colleges, as a PhD candidate. And I experimented a little with active learning techniques and things like that. So I think I tried to borrow a colleague's feudalism simulation where you had people swearing loyalty to lords and vassals and things like that. And then from there, I started to experiment a little bit with physical games, with board games, and made a couple for some students and continued to think that they were really powerful ways to get students engaged in the history, though I hadn't quite thought through exactly, why that might be. So I went from there into teaching high school, as I said, teaching at Cincinnati Country Day School. And I was so fortunate that they had the technological resources that I had a laptop and all of my students had a laptop. And so, and this was back in 2002 or three. Yes, a long time ago. And so I started to think about ways that I might use computer tools on top of physical games. And in 2004, that school year, I taught a course called Historical Simulations, where students were going to come in and we were actually going to play some, but make physical, board game historical simulations. In that class, as part of it, I thought, Civilization III was trending at the time. And I thought, this game doesn't do a bad job in general, broad brushstrokes, telling you about the ancient world and some of the systems in the ancient world. I wonder if I could have the kids play it and then we could talk about it as a simulation. So that was like my first use of it. So what, I guess 17 or 18 years ago. And what I found was there was interest there that I began to get invitations to conferences to speak and things like that, and invitations to do writing on games and history because it was resonating with people, but there weren't many people who could really speak to how it was being used. So that led me to write the book in an act of, I guess, courage or foolishness. I decided that I would write the book based on my experiences as a teacher. So this would be 2010 that I'd write it and I'd submit it to Routledge and we'd go from there. And I did. And it was apparently very well received. I won't tell you how small the number of sold copies is, but apparently in academic books fields, that's very well received, they told me. Needless to say, I have not retired yet on the funds from the book. But it went so well and people were so positive about it in the community over the next decade or so that I had the opportunity to revise it into a second edition. And so that's what came out in 2023, this second edition of Gaming the Past. And the through line is I wanted to have a practical guidebook for people who said, yeah, I want to use historical games in my history classes. How do I do it?
Yeah. And this seems to be this very point you were mentioning, actually, a handbook, a guideline, something you can work with. This is so important. Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me that there's still this enormous gap between the more theoretical frameworks or side when it comes, for example, to conferences, and really people who need to have something in their hands to work with, something practical. So this book is really groundbreaking.
Well, thank you. That's really my sense is that I don't know what one says about themselves. I do okay as a scholarly thinker. I do okay. But at the end of the day, what I really enjoy doing is translating some of that more abstract discussion into something that somebody can use in a classroom. To me, implementation is the most exciting part of education. I think there's a lot of ideas out there and I think they're really good, but education is enriched when people who are experts in their fields get translated, become practical, become useful.
So let's start our deep dive then. It seems that the very foundation of your book can be summarized with the following premise. Historical games can serve as a critical learning tool. And I'd like to talk to you about certain aspects that focus upon this credo with coming from different angles. So maybe let's start with the first one. You describe video games as an important form of new media and a popular form of participatory public history.
So I really believe games are am I going to say it? Oh, I think they're unique. I really think they are. I understand that they remediate. I understand that they copy. I understand that you can do very powerful and moving interactive things with other media, depending about how you define it. And the thing that a game does to me that seems to be its particular province, the game as a medium, the thing that it does and it does better than any other medium is it lets a player make choices that affect the story, choices that affect the, if you want, the diegetic level, but really just choices that affect the story. And all other media give you lots of choices, but very rarely do they give you the ability to make choices that affect the outcome of the story. And so to me, that is kind of a core point. And then the idea of a new media, one of the things that we talk about very often in secondary education, and I assume it gets talked about a fair amount in collegiate education, is the different media that students are exposed to and how, right, we have, it's getting better, but we have often taught as if text is the only way that one could communicate ideas properly. And, you know, the only way to critique ideas properly. And so video games, you know, challenge that. And I think, you know, they have become more and more. I mean, it used to be, I have some colleagues who don't like it when we justify the importance of video games by looking at sales. So I'm not going to look at recent sales, but we all know it's out there. The video game medium is incredibly popular, incredibly broad. And so understanding that the historical ones of these make claims about history. And perhaps in the critique, we can learn more about history and about critical studies of history by looking at the claims that they've made. And then popular history is something I've come to. I wish I were a better popular historian. I don't think I fully qualify, although I did write a companion article for one of the handbooks. Right, this idea of history that is being taken and adapted and interpreted and appreciated by people outside academia, outside formal educational circumstances. And we talk about museums and historical parks, and people talk about theater and things as public history. Video games are too. They're very rarely made by devoted historical academics. They're made by bright, interesting people who are interested in interpreting the past. And I think kids should look at that.
I was just thinking when you were mentioning actually sales, because I just wrote a text yesterday for some form of internal newsletter. And of course, I was writing about sales as a door opener, you know, some kind of life hack if you want to talk about games. And the moment I was writing this very sentence down, I thought, oh, it's the trap again.
Mm-hmm. It is.
But
we are in a capitalist society, right? And so we consciously or unconsciously justify things in terms of sales.
Yeah. You also see historical games then as excellent tools for thinking about human agency and human choices and actions within systems. And then I thought you will make a lot of ludologists very happy with this argument, I guess.
And did you, when you said ludologists, I saw your note there. Did you mean as opposed to narratologists?
Right, yeah. Because we're talking about systems and rules and mechanics.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is it. This is real talk. Now we're talking, man.
Yeah, if you followed my timeline, I was starting working on this stuff in 2004 or 2005. So my initial readings, as I tried to grab every book I could, were very much locked into the debate of ludology.
Totally,
versus
narratology.
I think that story is very important in historical games. It has to be, right? Because you've got to have some kind of narrative experience either while you're going along, if that's in fact how we make narrative, or constructing it after the fact, right? You have to have some kind of narrative, because history would imply some kind of narrative construction, right? At least cause and effect and things like that. So it's important, but yeah, I'm very interested in the mechanics. I'm interested in all video games, and I'm trying to, you know, kind of cast as or historical video games, and I'm trying to cast as wide a net as possible for teachers about these types of games. But my I don't think it's much of a secret. My particular passion is for games that are modeling systems. So as much as I love to play an Assassin's Creed, I get much more intrigued as a teacher by a civilization, for example, with its systems that allowing people to kind of make arguments about the past that are based on systems rather than based on just visuals. So if you look at it that way, right, you're a player agent, and you're in a world where you get to make choices within systems. And sometimes you're allowed to do things, and sometimes you're not allowed to do things, and you make these choices and you have effects to your choices. So that's going on in every historical video game. And that to me is a pretty useful analogy for thinking about our world, right? Where there are lots of world systems and we can't you know, control all of them, and we can work with some of them and avoid others and make choices.
And I guess this idea of human agency is captured in your idea about historical problem spaces then.
I hope so. So about a decade ago, I was doing some writing with the Play of the Past blog, which was a great early group of historical game studies folks.
Yeah, I remember.
It's still live. You can still check it out. Play of the Past. There was a great conversation going on at the time by some scholars who were looking at Sid Meier's Colonization, the remake, the 2008 remake, and really taking it to task for a lot of the deeply problematic sort of imperial colonial messages that were going on in that. And it was a discussion about how Native Americans are depicted problematically in the game, and a discussion about enslavement and the lack of African enslavement in a game that is focused on colonialism and imperialism, right? Which is perhaps the initial perpetrators of African slavery in some sense. And they were great. And what I remembered thinking to myself, though, was, I don't know if our game designers are thinking about, they're not thinking about the world like a critic, probably, because, I mean, that's sort of a different mode of what you're doing. They're thinking about the world as game designers. And so this idea then that games are historical problem spaces, if you look at a historical game, any historical game, it's basically going to portray the world in terms of an actor, I call him a player agent, in a game world with a goal set by the designers. And if the player agent chooses to pursue those goals, that game world is going to have things that help them and things that hinder them. And if you think about it, right, that's the deal. If any history game, so let me stop for a second. I'm not sure you can have a historical game that doesn't have a historical world implied, at least. If it's got a world, then it's got an actor with some kind of goals set for it, and it's trying to achieve, and the player may choose to achieve those goals. So I think that's really the key to understanding historical games as a medium and teaching them, is to understand that they're not giving you an open narrative. They're not giving you a linear story. They're giving you an identity to take on, a world that you're in, some kind of goals that, if you choose to pursue them, because you don't have to, right, that you will go through that world and you'll interact with things. And a lot of your interaction will be based on, is this going to help me or is this going to harm me? So I think that's a really important way. It makes for easier analysis and getting kids to understand, or getting students to understand, the details of games. But I think it also says something about why historical video games look the way they do so often.
In your next talking point, then, you frame historical games as a tool which can be used to encourage and foster historical questioning and criticism. And you also add the learning itself comes from those questions and criticism from so-called purposeful play.
Yes, indeed. So I think there's an idea, and sometimes I'm having conversations with people in the past from a decade or so. You had a question later on about whether, you know, some criticisms were still being levied about games, but so maybe nobody's doing this. I doubt it. There seems to be this idea for some that a historical game could only teach if it is an accurate historical game. And historical accuracy is a loaded term. I end up having to get into all sorts of debates with people when I use it. For me, historical accuracy, for me, at least in terms of a game, means something that conforms reasonably to the available historical evidence. So that's what I mean by it. But the idea that it has to be that way, that it has to present you a real presentation or an accurate presentation of the past in order to be useful, there's a couple of problems there. One, again, the term's very problematic. What does it mean to be accurate? And how is it possible for a particular point of view to be the only point of view on something? So there's that problem. And then it leans into this other problem of history should not be conceived of as the study of somebody's list of causes and events and facts and interpretations. That's not what history is. It's an inquiry, right? So this idea that you need to have an accurate game, and as if somehow you would have the kids play the game, they would, you know, soak up the history, and then they would be able to repeat it to you, on a essay or in a multiple choice test or some. That I think that cheapens what history is. So for me, the question is not, is the game accurate? The question is, does it promote useful critique and analysis of the past? So in my mind, I like to have games that have what I call defensible models. So I like to have games that are, you know, not horrible interpretations of the past in some way. So, you know, despite all of its other, you know, problems, the civilization games, right, make an argument that geography influences the development of states and cultures. That's a defensible historical argument. They do lots of other things that aren't so defensible. As long as I like those, but ultimately what I want to ask my students to do and what I want other teachers to ask their students to do is get some evidence and critique the game. Because by critiquing, by saying this game doesn't match up with the evidence, you kind of have to know what the evidence is. To say that this game doesn't match a reasonable historical narrative, you kind of have to know what that reasonable historical narrative is. So I think that's where the real intellectual growth happens, as you learn to criticize and challenge these popular media and not take them as, you know, scriptural truth.
And this connects very well to the next point, actually, because after that, you elaborate on the significance of the relevance of humanity's engagement with technology. So maybe let's have a deep dive into this in order to gain a better understanding for our listeners here.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Sure. So procedural literacy, this this is a term that doesn't always show up outside of educational circles. We're not talking about procedural rhetoric, which is important in its own right, developed by Bogost. We're talking about procedural literacy. Students need to be literate in how computer devices function. They don't have to be able to design them, but they really will benefit from understanding how they work. We're seeing that right now, right, with ChatGPT, the artificial intelligence. I don't know if you been playing with that over in Germany? And so, just to use that as a basic point, many of us, myself included, thought that chat AI came up with answers by knowing the rules of English grammar and providing meaningful responses to things that we typed in because they seemed so meaningful. The answers seem like they're written by a conscious being, not necessarily the most well-studied being, but a conscious being. But that's not how it works at all, is my understanding. Apparently, it's the same as your cell phone, right? As your smartphone with the fill in the next word function, except for it's a statistical model of billions of sentences across the internet. So when it writes a sentence for you, what it says is, okay, whatever, 80% of the time, this word comes right after this word in people's prose. That's procedural literacy, understanding that. Understanding that it's basically just playing the odds on words and not really having any kind of functioning with grammar or rules or things like that helps us understand that this is not, this is not the end. This is not the robots taking us over. This is a tool that is very limited in very important ways. And so there we go. Thanks to ChatGPT for giving us some topicality. I want students to understand computers as much as they can. I want them to understand the smartphones. I want them to understand laptops. I want them to understand, their Alexa speakers. Programming classes are fantastic for that, but it shouldn't be the case that the only way that students get involved with procedural literacy, with understanding computers and how they operate, through a programming class. So using historical games in history classes can kind of bridge that gap, because you can start to talk with people about very simple but important concepts. You can talk about variables, for example, in how the game stores things. That I have one part of my historical problem spaces is resources, and resources would be stored in a game as variables, and you can talk about game storage or computers. Branching choices, right? The idea that at the end of the day, those computer games are designed so that they have a series of binary choices, and they either do one or the other. And so at the level of code, there's very little fuzziness. It's very much what I would call a mathematical model or a formal model. Understanding that as well. Those are some of the big ones, I think. But it kind of serves this next point, right? That we know, I mean, certainly at least I hear about it all the time, how much humanities is in the decline. I think history departments are really under fire in the United States, it sounds right, as far as keeping their numbers up of professors and things like that. And yet we seem to keep seeing over and over and over that technology, if it's going to be truly helpful, truly meaningful, truly ethical, needs to have humanities thinking involved in the questions of why we do things and how we do things and what it means. And so I can't solve all those things in my ninth grade class playing with a video game, but maybe I can start to have them think about, right, about AI and what does it mean for a computer to make choices? And are these things we might be able to extend to broader conversations about technology?
Yeah, speaking of progress, I was a bit surprised when I read your next thoughts. And let me quote here, using games as a learning tool does not conflict with exercise in critical reading and writing. And I was wondering, is this really something that is still being brought up by, for example, your colleagues?
So I don't hear it very often, but I work I'm really privileged to work at a fantastic school that prioritizes quality progressive education, I think. I've been here 20 years, so I enjoy this place very much. I hear it in places, and I try to be sensitive to educators who are in lots of different environments. The original chapter was written in 2010, when absolutely I was hearing more often, quite simply, that games are remedial. That if you use a game or simulation in a history class, you're doing it because my students are kids, but I understand in college they're not kids. The idea that if you're using a game or a simulation or anything like that, it's because the kids can't handle real history, with the prejudice being that real history is in text and real history should be written about. And so that was definitely something I was responding to and trying to come up with a set of intelligent arguments. Hopefully they're intelligent. For how you might talk to people who are in that mindset, say your principal is in that mindset or your department chair or things like that. So that may be overcompensating, but I think it's not for this, because reading and writing, critical reading and writing, are still very, very important as things to educate our students in, whatever level of education they go through. The ability to express themselves and the ability to take meaning from others' thoughts and text, these are really important skills. So I sort of cast it as, hey, if you're worried about this, that you're not going to have kids reading and writing, don't worry about it. And hey, I want to celebrate too that that is an important goal. It's not the only thing that that kids should be helped, taught to interpret, but it's important. So my classes are actually, in some ways, they're very traditional classes as far as assessment, because many of my assessments are written essays. They just happen to be about video games sometimes and how they interpret the past. The game is the exploration tool. The game is the medium of presentation, if you will. It's all those things. You can actually demonstrate your learning in that in any number of ways, and that includes writing. That's what I was going for there. I think it's still being brought up in places, but I think I hope we're moving along as a species and understand. I mean, it does kind of come up every 100 years or so. It's not like this is the first time in our lives that in the world that somebody has said, you know, learning's not about just pouring facts into somebody's head. Learning is about, you know, inspiring interest and getting people to think. That's thousands of years old, that argument. Plutarch made that argument in the 100s.
Ah, good old Plutarch.
I know, right?
Yes.
And so I think he said it was supposed to be a fire. You're supposed to light the fire of enthusiasm. So I don't think it's gone. I think that maybe many of us are getting better about understanding that there are rich ways to interact with the world critically beyond just reading and writing. But I still think it's there for people who need it. If you don't need it because everybody's on board with you, fantastic. At least I have it there in the book for somebody who wants to kind of talk through this with a more reluctant supervisor.
Mm-hmm. And your last talking point finally is labeled as a missing, I see my air quotes here, missing one. It states, why fun is not an argument for using games and why engagement is a more accurate term. Has this point, in your opinion, been left out of the discussion so far?
Yeah. I think we're getting, well, I don't know if we're getting better on this one. I seem to be one of the few, but when I talk to people, they recognize it. Let me give you a little historical context. When I first started doing my work on games and history learning, I was spending my time at one of the main conferences I would go to is the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Games, Learning, and Society Conference. Kurt Squire, who's at University of California, Irvine, and a good friend and somebody who sort of really helped me along because he was in charge of many of those things and brought me along to them. So shout out to Kurt if he ever hears this. Yeah, no. At that time, I was there mostly with game designers and non-history teacher educators, but a lot of game designers and a lot of people in the academic field of games and learning. And there was an assumption in the air for many people, not everybody, for many people that games in themselves are inherently interesting and engaging. And all you need to do to have games and learning is get the right game in front of the students and they will be engaged and they will play it and the learning will just take place and it's going to be a wonderful thing. And part of that too is the idea of the digital native. I haven't heard that term used very much recently. I think it's because we've moved beyond the first generation of people who have had computers all their lives. I mean, I was the last generation that didn't have personal computers all their lives. I was born in 72 and 81 was the PC. But we used to talk about these digital natives, this idea of these kids will automatically take to computers and computer games and learn and it'll be great. And it just wasn't so for me. What I found, and I've continued to find it, is first and foremost, a student who has to play a video game for an academic assignment is in a fundamentally different mindset from that same person if they privately said, "Oh, I want to play this game," and they took it on.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. It's pretty straightforward when you think about it. But it's something that it's not addressed in many tutorials when developers make tutorials. It's not addressed in the way that many people talk about playing with games. And I get that. All of us talking about games love games,
yeah.
and you know, and so we do. We learn it. We drink lots of coffee. And I mean, you know, I'm from the age when you had to read the game manual, right? They had 100-page game manuals, and we read them. But a student who's being assigned this is a student who may very well not like games like the one you're playing, feel that playing games makes them a gamer, and that might be an identity that they like or they don't like or feel alienated by. They don't have the props or the sort of intrinsic learning things that we have, right? When we learn something because we value it, right, we have all these thought processes going on, checking our learning. Do I understand this? How do I figure this out? Right. Yeah, metacognition is usually the term. That isn't necessarily the case for a student being required to learn. So going from that, I really did not want to use games are fun as an argument. One, as I said, because it really depends on the person, and the environment is so much different from a student who's being assigned a game and required to play it. But two, fun doesn't equal educationally viable. You know, there are educational things that are fun. It's absolutely true. We can learn through having fun. But something being fun in and of itself doesn't mean that it's going to sort of result in any kind of formal educational learning. There's got to be more to it than that. For example, I don't assign essays to my students because they're fun. I don't say, "Hey, how would you feel if we got to read this ancient source and you could write me an essay arguing about the main point of the author there? Wouldn't that be fun?" And right? And they'd be like, "Yeah." we wouldn't do it. So I think that needs to be continued. I think that as we talk about games in history education, we need to continue to think about how can we use simplicity to get students to onboard? How can we use tutorials better? How can teachers budget time better to just deal with the reality that you have lots of different learners coming to these games and you're going to need to think about how they learn them?
Yeah.
But engagement, I think, is real. I think there is something about seeing a moving system and getting to critique the parts and being empowered and saying, "Go at this. Tell us what's wrong with it. Tell us what's not working so well." I think that is more engaging than simply sitting and having somebody tell you what happened in the past and why.
Yeah. Well, we are entering the final round now, so to speak. And this is the time, actually, where I'd like to ask my guests always for a little meta-reflection. Okay. What aspects and ideas would you have loved to include in your, revised book, but maybe there is a version 3.0, who knows, not make the cut? And secondly, I'm really excited to ask this one. Where do you see digital game studies as a research field in general at the moment?
Yeah, great questions. So I'm really happy with how 2.0 happened, Gaming the Past, but there's absolutely places that I would have wanted to include. I would have liked to have, and when I say more time, the time was on me. I wanted a second edition out, and I wanted it to be out in a reasonable amount of time. So I could have spent longer doing it. Routledge would surely have let me, but I really wanted to get it done. So if I do slip and say I wanted to have time, I want to be clear that was on me. But one of the things I felt I didn't have time for, and I definitely didn't have space for, was mobile games. I think I mentioned them, but I think that they are a reality. They are one of the major ways. They are one of the major ways that people encounter video games, and so I would have liked to study them more. I would have liked to, think about them. I talked a bit in a draft about one genre. We didn't talk about it really, and that's okay. Genre is a critical part of all of this with historical problem spaces and all. Games genres shape their histories. So I was looking at mobile games of the type like Dominations and Rise of Cultures and things like that, where you're right building a civilization, but you've got a limited amount of actions that you can take, and you can pay more money if you want to get more actions. And so I called them, I forget, like time labor management games. I would have liked to do more with that. And I want to experiment with using mobile games in the classroom. So that would have been a good, that would have been a good place to do it. But it would have required, I have lots to learn, and there are people who are much farther along in this than me that I'm going to borrow from. Shout out, Kate. And yes, okay, so that would be one of them. I would have liked to include a full kind of historical problem space appendix that like listed all the terms and everything in a nice place, because I think it presents it really well. But I would love to just have a section in there that teachers could draw from and be like, okay, here's my handbook. This is how we can talk about analyzing games. So those would be some things that I would like to add. But really, I was very happy to have a chance 10 years later to really go back in, and a lot of the things that I assumed or held true, I didn't anymore, and to really kind of update it for a new group of educators. Game studies as a research field. So other people have talked much more eloquently about this than I have. I believe Andrew Elliott at Addigra Italia, there's a video you can still look at on where historical game studies are coming. They're everywhere. I think we're starting to get to the point where people are recognizing historical game studies as a bit of a field. But it's really early. You know, the actual, if you count, you know, if you count it in terms of monographs and my books among them, then historical game studies have only been around about a decade. And we didn't necessarily recognize we were anything for a while. So, I think, the places that excite me the most as far as game studies as a research field, my area is on what I would call kind of the design side, the developer side. I'm very interested in how designers and developers act as historians and make these digital works. And there are, you know, with my historical problem space framework, I focus a lot on the internal structures of games. There's all sorts of other developer work that needs to be done. That's really great. Ilva Grufsted came out with a book last year that I got to be an editor on, and the title escapes me, but it's with Dick Reuter and it's Ilva Grufsted. And it is on Paradox, the Paradox company, and how sort of real life, everyday strictures and structures and plans and purposes really shape the development process, shape the history that goes into games. And so that's a great one in this field. And Esther Wright came out with a book recently, also with De Gruyter, looking at Rockstar Games and looking at how, among other things, these are, I'm giving very simple accounts, but how the cinema, how Western cinemas influenced Red Dead Redemption. And so I think understanding more as much as we can where developers are getting their ideas from and how the external pressures shape it. That being said, the work on empire, the work on hegemony in video games that's being done is really, really exciting as well. Looking at how games often perpetuate the status quo and the idea of a largely white, largely male, largely Euro-American, largely, you know, and the list could go on, point of view in those games. And so I think that's getting really exciting too, is looking at sort of imperialism and hegemony. In education, what we need most, and some people are doing it, is more player studies. What are players taking away from historical games when they're playing them? What are they making, you know, how are they making sense about the past in those games? So those are some areas that I think we're going. But the thing that's great is historical game studies is looking at all sorts of stuff that I don't even know about yet. So I'm hoping for, you know, a really rich and varied next decade.
I'm trying to do my best.
Yes, you are, and I appreciate it. We don't get to all talk about this as much as we should. So thank you, Rudolf, for doing this. It's a great service.
No, thank you very much. Well, I've taken a lot of your time, so maybe, only maybe, what are you working on right now, and of course, what will you be playing next?
So I've got a couple of little things I'm working on that I don't think I'm supposed to talk about yet, so I won't.
Ooh, secret,
but the thing that I can talk, I know, right? It's not deeply secret. But the thing that I can talk about, I am in the peer review stage of a manuscript proposal for a second book with Routledge, sort of a follow-up. Called, oh my gosh, I can't remember the name. I had some clever name, but then they changed it to a more practical one because they're always trying to be practical editors. But basically, the book is this: how to, if you are a history educator or a game designer, how to make historical games, board games, and interactive text games that work in the classroom. How as an educator to make those games if you wanted to have games for your kids to learn about the past from. And then how to teach students in your classes to design physical games and text-based choice games. So I'm really excited because I think this is an area, in some ways it might seem old school, but it's not. Board games are still very much in their infancy of being really recognized by people as incredible things. I mean, they've been used for 50 years or more, but we're starting to give them proper respect now. And so I'm hoping to provide a guide that lets anybody say, okay, I can make games for a classroom of kids that would help them learn things, history games, and I can have them do their own games, because that's where the best learning, hands down, best historical learning that ever takes place involving games is when you have to design one yourself and you need to research it to make sure that it fits the evidence. So that's what I'm working on next, and I'm excited about it.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Awesome. So I hope, of course, then we will talk to each other maybe when the next project is due. And I really would love to do that because this sounds like a great project. So thank you. Thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. And well, take care and goodbye.
Thank you so much for the chance to do this. It's been great talking with you, Rudolf.
So, dear listeners, I hope you liked this episode. If you are an author and or an editor in the field of digital game studies yourself and want to talk about your latest publication, do not hesitate to contact me under rudolf.indust@googlemail.com. Alternatively, please send me a direct message on social media. You will find me under Rudolf Indust almost everywhere. See you in a bit.